50 years ago, on April 22nd, 1970, the first Earth Day, the first official Earth Day, I should say, hit the calendars. And Earth Day 1970 really gave voice to an emerging public consciousness about the state of our planet. In the decades leading up to the first Earth Day, Americans were consuming vast amounts of leaded gas. Do you remember this? Regular or unleaded? Most people use regular leaded gas through massive and inefficient automobiles, even though they look really cool. Industry belched out smoke and sludge with little fear of the consequences from either the law or bad press. Air pollution was commonly accepted as the smell of prosperity. And up until this point, mainstream America remained largely oblivious to the environmental concerns and how a polluted environment can threaten human health. However, the stage was set for change with the publication of Rachel Carson's New York Times bestseller, Silent Spring, back in 1962. The book represented a watershed moment, really, selling more than 500,000 copies in 24 countries as it raised public awareness and concern for living organisms, the environment as a whole, and really the inextricable links between pollution and public health. It was actually Senator Gaylord Nelson, a junior senator from Wisconsin, who had long been concerned about the deteriorating environment in the United States, that got the ball rolling. In January of 69, he and many others witnessed the ravages of a massive oil spill in Santa Barbara, California. And inspired by the student anti-war movement at the time, Senator Gaylord Nelson wanted to infuse the energy of student anti-war protests with an emerging public consciousness about air and water pollution. Senator Nelson announced the idea for a teach-in on college campuses to the national media and persuaded Peter McCloskey, a conservation-minded Republican congressman, to serve as his co-chair. They then recruited Dennis Hayes, a young activist, to organize the campus teach-ins, and they chose April 22nd, a weekday falling between spring break and final exams, to maximize the greatest student participation. Recognize its potential to inspire all Americans, Dennis Hayes built a national staff of 85 people to promote events across the land. They changed the name to Earth Day, which immediately sparked national media attention and caught on across the country. So instead of a teach-in, we went to Earth Day. It inspired 20 million Americans at the time, 10% of the total population of the United States, to take to the streets and parks and auditoriums to demonstrate against the impacts of 150 years of industrial development that left a growing legacy of serious human health impacts. I remember in 1969, prior to the first Earth Day, watching on television, on the news, the Cuyahoga River in Ohio burning because of the sludge and the garbage that was in there. And that's just the way things were. You'll hear this interview here shortly. I have a vivid memory of people just throwing garbage out the windows of their cars, dumping ashtrays at the stop sign. I mean, we used the earth as a garbage can for a very, very long time. Groups that had been fighting individually against oil spills, polluting factories, and et cetera, really united around this common concept. Earth Day 1970 actually achieved a rare political alignment, enlisting support from Republicans and Democrats, rich and poor, urban dwellers, farmers, business, labor leaders, you name it. By the end of 1970, the first Earth Day led to the creation of the United States Environmental Protection Agency and the passage of other first-of-their-kind environmental laws, including the National Environmental Education Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and the Clean Air Act. 2 years later, Congress passed the Clean Water Act. And a year after that, Congress passed the Endangered Species Act. And soon after that, Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. These laws have protected millions of men, women, and children from disease and death, and have protected hundreds of species from extinction. So here we are 50 years later. We've had a lot of wins and a lot of losses. It's interesting to me that Richard Nixon saw it at the time as a great political move. I don't think that anybody with any imagination would think that Richard Milhouse Nixon, I am not a crook, was all of a sudden this deep environmentalist. What he saw was a political opportunity, capitalized on it. But whatever reasons, the EPA was created, sorely needed. You know, for anybody that's all worried about government oversight, we need to make the government smaller, you know, okay, whatever. They've been beating that since 1776, day two, right? However, to think that industry in particular will just have some, you know, self-governing moral backbone out of nowhere and not dump stuff into the water or spew it into the air or burrow it into the ground is a fantasy. So we need oversight on this stuff, and that's what the EPA does. And so here we are with 50 years later, and so many thoughts going through my mind, and now it's become Earth Week to some degree, which is great. So you're hearing this podcast on the 50th anniversary. It's April 22nd. And just to be clear, you know, my degree from Northeastern Illinois University. I'm very proud of it. It was a self-designed degree with a very scientific background, and also a bend on communications is environmental interpretation and communication. And so what has become my trademark over the years is, for whatever reason, I've been given the opportunity and the ability to take complex material, break it down into bite-sized bits, and make it easily digestible for people so they can make change in their lives. That's really about it. I don't want to sit for 5 hours and listen to some big oration about what's going on with the planet. I want to know, what can I do where I'm at with what I have to make a difference, if at all possible? We are stewards of this planet. You don't have to like it, but that's really the way it shapes up. And on our watch, we have things to do. And this is what I do. And for 3 years, Bill Curtis and I created, produced, and hosted, and put into radio syndication a great series called Earth Matters. And as we got to the 50th anniversary and all the people I want to talk to about this stuff, last year was Jane Goodall. This year, I thought, I got to call BK and get him on the blower and have a discussion. Now, you have to understand, I've known the man 30 years, so there's not much we haven't already talked about or produced or aired. But it's always reassuring to me to hear where he's at and what's going on with him, as he has a far greater perspective on this than I do, from really a global journalist. So this conversation, I thought, has to happen today. So let's get him on the phone and see how it goes.
Hello, John.
BK, good morning. How are you?
I am good. I guess it was very good, and I dropped out immediately.
Yeah, well,
I was thinking about the quality in the audio.
Yeah, this is a nice set. When I do my regular podcast, it's all self-contained, and if I do have a guest on, it works out pretty well. I mean, you sound fine now, but I got to get the phone just right and get the electrical tape tight just right, and then make sure everything's all set and don't touch it for an hour.
So right.
We're good to go. So interesting to me, this is the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, and my first thought was, you must have some recollection how all that went down back when, Nixon created the EPA, the Cuyahoga River in Ohio was on fire, and people were really fed up. It was a different America in a lot of ways. I remember as a kid growing up, people literally throwing garbage out of the window of their car, dumping ashtrays, and there was garbage everywhere. Do you remember back in 70 how things were?
Oh, yes. And Walter Cronkite started a series on his broadcast called Can the World Be Saved? Mm. And if you think about it, it's very prescient. And we were fortunately on the West Coast and flying all over the 11 states out there, but we'd go into a forest fire and, down to the ocean. It sounds great now, and it was then. But we were touching on all the issues that have just gotten worse. So I was ready for it. But I remember on the specific day, I went down to Belmont Harbor, and there were a group of, you would call them tree huggers now, and they literally had us all put our arms around the tree and then say, okay, what kind of a tree are you?
And what tree were you, Bill? Were you a redwood?
No, I guess I was an oak. I didn't know enough to be anything else. Mm. But, it was cleaning up, and you had teams that went around, and very well-intentioned. But I got the feeling that most people didn't really appreciate the problems that we were facing, because it wasn't until 1958 that Charles Keating and Topham Mauna Loa started taking his readings on carbon dioxide increases. Mm-hmm. And then picked up along the way by James Hansen. And by the time we got to 88, we started racking up the hottest on record. Mm. And that's when it really began to sink in to people.
But for you as a journalist and a guy who, at that time you weren't doing the documentary films, and you didn't quite have the same platform that you have now. Were those early days when you were watching this as a journalist and being an oak tree at Belmont Harbor and all the rest, do you think that kind of influenced you to kind of go in this direction more than you might have?
I saw it as a real story. When you take the story off the feature page and put it on the front page, it was frustrating, too, and Al Gore found it frustrating, because you were talking about what could easily be, thought of as fantasy. Mm-hmm. So far in the future, oh, that'll never happen to us. And we talked about, the turn of the century, or, the amount of carbon dioxide, won't be dangerous until the turn of the, well, geez, that's a long way away.
Right.
And then it's the next turn of the century. So it was hard to nail it down and get people to appreciate it. Mm. Now, I'm not sure that a lot are, the coronavirus, you appreciate that because it's life and death. But to me, this whole preparation, the masks, the washing of the hands, the wearing of the gloves, is just preparation for the really big one.
Mm.
And that is when the world changes.
And so
we're going through a behavioral practice.
Yeah.
When it's so serious that you literally have to change your priorities and the way you are doing things. And if we can make it stick, I don't think we can, but at least it'll enter our memories. So when the big one does come along, mm-hmm. We'll know what it's like.
Many, many years ago, we were doing a show when I was on the air in Michigan, and our friend, the late, great Senator Paul Simon, who was a huge advocate for environmental responsibility, we were all doing a show together, and you made a comment to the fact, and it was after 9/11, that until where there's an environmental-type 9/11, we're not really going to wake up. We feel very privileged here in this country. All the bad stuff happens somewhere else. But this time it's here. And depending, I guess, on how you research the cause or the source of where this happened, I've done some work and some other people looked into it. It's everything from the, a laboratory in China let the virus out to do whatever, to the bats are chewing on the pangolins that are in the wet markets and somebody eats it. And so, but the point really almost now is secondary to the fact that we are a global society, whether you like it or not. You just want to buy USA-made, good luck, because we've been in a global economy for 60, 70 years. So when you look at this, does this seem like an environmental 9/11 to you?
Well, it's hard to connect the environmental connection with people. I've been to the wet markets from Thailand to Hong Kong. You walk down the sidewalk in Hong Kong, and they're selling cobras in the window.
Mm.
And the cobra, you eat the meat, but you also drink the blood to give you that Viagra kind of stability.
Yeah, well.
And, the Chinese believe in Oriental medicine. They've practically wiped out the rhinoceros.
Yeah.
They're working on the elephant because they want that strength that comes from strong animals. And I don't think they even know, they're smart. And if you explain to them what the hell is happening with the world population, they might change.
Mm.
But there's still so many of them. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who don't get the word. I've also, been to the Middle East and been to especially the rainforests. And so I have seen it. I've been there when the fires are burning. I've been there when the gold miners, sounds like the Old West, the gold miners were invading the territory of the Yanomami, an indigenous Indian tribe that is right on the northern border at Boa Vista, a town there that starts the Amazon. And they give them, the white man gives tuberculosis to the Indians and cuts down. There, one of my favorite documentaries is down in Ecuador, La Guagria, where the oil companies have come in, and they don't care about anything except they just throw the excess oil into the river. And so the Cofan Indians, studied by the Field Museum, are drinking out of the river, they're washing out of the river, and keep moving downstream to get away from the oil. And the Ecuador, needs and wants the money,
mm-hmm.
rather than jumping in and cleaning it up. So, I've seen the problems firsthand.
One of the things...
But
go ahead.
And the coronavirus, I'll tell you one story. I hope I haven't told you before. We were doing a documentary on nuclear cutbacks. Senator Lugar from Indiana had a program that caused the Russians to open up in the spirit of working together. And they said, sure, come on over. We'll show you anything. And so they, you know, wanted to talk about nuclear. But they led us into a science city about 70 miles outside of Moscow. And they were ringed. The city was ringed by these. And it was a biological and chemical warfare lab. And when we walked in, you know, the utility fence that was supposed to be a safety defense was torn, falling down. There wasn't a security guard at the front. So I said, well, this place is closed. But we go in, and it wasn't closed. Hmm. You know, where are you going to put the plague? Where are you going to put anthrax that you've been studying? The safest is to just leave it there.
Yeah.
Inside the building. And so the first floor was the study of anthrax. Second floor was the study of plague. Third floor was the study of Ebola. And when I say study, I mean weaponizing it to, you know, release in subways and the world. Because they had the notion. And the fourth was viruses. HIV, you know, Ebola. And I was crazy enough to get in a maximum security Gumby suit, you know, where they wrap you all up. And that was spooky because I didn't have enough oxygen and had to get out of it fast. But there it was in all its glory. And they had been working in this city for years. It is exactly the kind of facility that sounds, I haven't been to Wuhan, it sounds like what they were working on. And, you know, they describe it not as weaponizing these things, but it's just a turn of a key and you've got a weapon. It was, they were investigating the virus for HIV and malaria. And there is now a theory that maybe they joined together, combined these two, and somehow it leaked. Well, it's being nice to say it accidentally leaked out. You know, we need a little more information to figure out whether it was an intentional release. Of course, they wouldn't release it on their own people. But the fact is that there is this industry. And if we take nuclear and everybody says, well, it's too dangerous to, you know, we'll blow ourselves up too. So let's put that aside. Here is a silent, invisible weapon that you could release in a subway. And, you know, take out the city, or in this case, a country. How far will it go? And we are quite right to get upset that we didn't have any warning at the release or something else, because we didn't have any time to develop the scientific defenses. They'll come, but, you know, if they come in September, that means we've killed that many more people. Anyway, so as a journalist, you see a lot of things. You don't do original research, you know, of pouring liquid from one test tube to another. But by God, you do understand who is doing that. And you have we're generalists and can come back and should tell the world. So you ask a question, is there a connection between coronavirus? There's a connection. And we're tearing down nature. And we're taking away the defenses that nature has built for its own species. And we are so vulnerable, they're coming right for our lungs. And, you know, we'll find something. I was encouraged yesterday, you know, can't tear myself away from the television set. Hey, what else do I have to do?
Right.
And there was a doctor who had recovered, and he got up to the point of a ventilator. he said I was dreaming that I wouldn't have to put a pipe in my throat. But he described what turned the corner, and he said, first of all, there was a drug, and it started with an E and went by fast, that went into the lungs first and caused them to open up. So you're fighting not the whole thing at once, but lungs. Then you go into the larger picture, and maybe there's a malaria kind of defense or a remdesivir, and you can fight that. But he had recovered, and he was out, and he was talking, giving an interview. You know, they'll figure it out.
Right.
We'll figure it out. But there's a lot of pain in between.
One of the things that's been most fascinating to me in all the work that I've done, and some of the work you and I've done together, is the human factor in this. Meaning, if there was ever a time when humans should be realizing we are the least important and yet most impactful species on the planet, it would be now. And as the air has cleared, as people have stayed off the streets, the air is cleared, the water is cleared, the land is getting a break. There's a lot of byproduct of us not doing what we normally do. And that's self-evident. You can see it all over the place.
Yeah.
The news is there. And yet there's still such a strong denial factor in not everybody, but enough people that it causes a problem. You know, pointing out about oil being thrown in the river, that's what we did 150 years ago until they started cleaning this shit up. So I see where, you know, there's this always this juxtaposition. And I was thinking about it earlier, and I think this experience that you and I had back in 1999 really illustrates this line where people are at. And you had just the week before been at the White House and premiered Earth in the Hot Seat in 1999. And we flew you up from Chicago to the bustling metropolis of Escanaba in Michigan's Upper Peninsula at Bay College. It was a packed house. You're going to show the video. It was about an hour. And it was you and your team went around the world for like a year and got evidence, you know, experience and evidence of the changes that were going on because of global warming, climate change, whatever you want to call it. And some of the two of the things that really stood out was there was this image of these utility poles that had been buried in permafrost that were tilted at a 45-degree angle because the permafrost was melting. They never thought it would melt. That's why it's called permafrost. And that there was another type of beetle, I don't recall the name of this beetle, that was, you know, gnawing its way through the forests because it was warmer, and these beetles would usually die off. And then that harm, in turn, decreased the lumber that was available, which in turn affected jobs, which in turn affected the market. So these things were all connected. So we show the whole thing.
Yeah.
Show the whole thing, and you took questions. And I will never, ever forget this. First guy stands up. Says, Mr. Curtis, with all due respect, I love you on A&E, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I've been in the woods for 20 years up here. I've never seen any of this. So what I think, this is all bullshit. It's just a liberal agenda. And you said,
that's right.
Well, you remember that? And you said this, and I thought, how do you remember that? And you said, thank you. Next question. And the guy just kind of looked like he was ready to argue, but there was no argument. And the next person stood up and said, I'm a mom. I have three little kids. I'm very concerned about this. What can I do? And those two people, to me, were really the core sample of how most people feel about environmental things. Here's one guy that says, I got 20 years in the woods. This is not true. I've never seen it, so it can't exist. Here's a woman who has three children who says, I'm going to trust what this journalist who's traveled the world and showing me these images are, that it's not an agenda. It's an awareness, and it's an alarm clock going off. And I think that Achilles heel in the middle is such a huge problem for us.
Yes, that proves how journalism has changed a little bit. Now we need pictures, and the video. Mm-hmm. That the Tongass forest looked like it had just been burned, and mm-hmm. it was a result of the beetles.
Yeah.
If you go now to the Rocky Mountain National Park. You go to Estes Park, and on the eastern side of the largest summit, it looks pretty good. Then you get up to the peak, and you look down the western side, and that same burnt look the Beatles have totally destroyed it. Mm-hmm. And I looked around, and when I was there a couple of years ago, and I said, doesn't anybody know this? This is a terrible story. You know, this is front page news.
Sure.
Maybe I just missed it. But the cycle is going to have to happen. It'll either all burn or all cut down and let the little firs start growing again and the pines. But the values of the homes and the beauty of it, and,
sure,
you know, is just as a result of, I think, Ojibwe's were inviting us in, weren't they? And we sat in a big teepee. And,
yep.
And I think one of them introduced me as, here is the man who speaks for the earth.
Indeed he did.
And it just paralyzed me. It was so perfect and great. Well, you know, what will change behavior? What will be one of those moments when you hear both sides right in front of you? Coronavirus is one step further. But we have to connect it. See, it's not clearly connected with cutting down the forests or burning the rainforest, that kind of thing. You see stories, but even then, you know, okay, you were cutting into, let's say, a pangolin or a bat. Where does the bat get it?
Right.
Well, I think maybe now it landed and fed on waste. You can have waste, you know, with the virus in it. That is a possibility, rather than it, unless, you know, it lives within us and has for years in a weakened state.
I'm
waiting for the big one.
Yeah, it's still. And when you said that earlier, this, the hair on my arm kind of went up. I'm like, the big one. And, you know, I look at this as, like you said, an experimentation in human behavior and how we respond or react to these things. For 3 years, you and I produced 300 episodes, about 100 a year, called Earth Matters, that aired in syndication and radio. And I've always, the reason I think that the impetus for the whole idea came was that I at one time really felt, and this might be partially true, that information can lead to transformation, that if you feed information to people in bite-sized bits that is not scientifically overblown or overdone and that they can understand what we're talking about, and we could add, you know, the voice of the anchorman to the whole thing and we got it really tight and the production's good and all that, that it would be something that offsets a lot of the non-information, to put it lightly, that pervades so much of the internet and the media and even radio and television and newspaper and print and whatever. And so we did those for a long time, and we would always get really interesting feedback. And one of the ones that was most interesting to me is something that happened with those microbeads that were in facial scrub.
There are many different kinds of invasive species that threaten life in the waterways of America. But recently, a new man-made scourge has surfaced. Zebra mussels have decimated the waters of the Great Lakes, consuming plankton at such a high rate that actually threatens the fish population in that area. But who knew that simply washing your face or hands, or even brushing your teeth, would put a substance into the water that never goes away? Researchers have discovered vast amounts of plastic microbeads, the abrasive particles that scrub away dirt and grime, and then get washed down the drain, and eventually end up in the water system. The beads don't dissolve. The best way you can help to keep polyethylene out of the water is to simply use a good biodegradable soap. I'm Bill Curtis, and Earth Matters.
You know, I don't know why there's polyethylene beads in those, but somebody thought it was a good idea. They put them in, come to find out that in Lake Erie, especially for some reason, the microbeads, once you washed your face, would go down the drain, and they were so small, they'd get through the water filtration plant, end up in the sewer lines, and head out into the dump into Lake Erie. And that they were finding these, what they first thought were fish eggs, but turned out to be polyethylene beads. And we did a series on this, three or four of these, and it helped shape policy locally here in Illinois. And then it got to the higher level. And eventually Obama, one of the last things he did before he left office was to ban the use of polyethylene beads in facial scrubs. Now, look, you don't have to be Einstein to figure out that there's about 100 other things you could use in facial scrubs, and they use them now. So on one hand, the information we provided was a spark of some sort to create action that made positive change. On the other hand, I really used to think, and you have far more experiences than I do, that with the advent of everything on the internet and this incredible tool, that information would make us smarter, more connected, and you know, kind of more of a human family. I don't think that's happening.
No, it is happening.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
Tell me.
You know, we as journalists or information folks are the water in a coming to boil when the frogs are still in there. One day they'll wake up and they'll realize, oh, I've seen this before. I know that. I've learned it. And I came to the conclusion that all the nature documentaries that we love seeing, the big animals, and the science documentary, all these stories do have an effect, but not an immediate effect.
Okay,
it's just like coronavirus. You know, there isn't a direct line. In the law, you'd call it the best evidence, direct evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not quite there. And then I was, you know, it's easy to get frustrated if you're a journalist because you want every story to have an impact and change life. But it's a longer process because we're dealing with behavior and habit. And ingrained in the way we make money, the way we have grown used to the food we eat, everything we touch and eat, you know, contributes to this and has to be redone. Agriculture will have to be rejiggered, if you want. We can't be plowing up and releasing carbon every time we put a tractor in a field. It's got to be no-till. And so here, on my little farm up north, we are working with the students from Northwestern Loyola Botanic Garden to find a wild wheatgrass that doesn't have to be plowed. You put it in once, it's perennial.
Mm-hmm.
And then it shoots down roots that eventually reach about 10 feet and produces a grain. Now, it'll take a while for the grain to be as thick and juicy and lucrative as the regular wheat hybrid grain that they've been working on for decades. But if we can create value in the wild prairie, we'll have both the second best repository or bank, if you will, for storing carbon from the atmosphere in the earth. And that's a day we could reduce carbon dioxide almost by a third if we properly manage the grasslands with something like that. And then we'll have something to eat. So farmers, you know, everybody is shocked when you say, yeah, we have 27 million acres or more of corn growing in Illinois. We have more than any other state.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't eat it. It's all for cattle.
Yes.
And it has been scientifically hybridized to the point where it's high in sugar and starch. So it's designed to make cattle gain weight fast. It doesn't taste good to humans, and it doesn't have no nutrition in humans. Well, the farmers do it because that's the market, and that's the only market they have. And so they're forced into large silos, 150 pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer for every acre they plant. They're planting on chemicals rather than the rich soil we all think Illinois has. And those chemicals destroy the top 5 feet or more of our soil. So, and every year they have to do that for every crop they plant into plowed fields. That's got to change. Look at meat. The slaughterhouses with the coronavirus are now shutting down because the workers that harkened back to Upton Sinclair in 1921 here in Chicago.
Yeah.
The workers are getting sick. So they have shut them down, and which means that the rancher in the field has nowhere to sell it. Usually he sells to the factory farms, the feedlots, mm-hmm. that fatten them up. And then in the river of meat, 93 million pounds of cattle that we have in the United States, we harvest about 36 million. And if they have nowhere to go to be slaughtered and sent on to the Burger Kings and McDonald's, you talk about shutting down real fast.
Well,
a business.
It's like the ripple effect times a thousand, because, and that's the other thing I think that is so prominent during this Cyrus the Virus attack here that we're all under to some degree, greater or lesser, is that you see real quick, at least I have, that all the chest beating and the flag waving and we're number one and we're the greatest, most powerful nation on earth ain't exactly true. Meaning that everything's connected to something else. And as soon as one part of the puzzle's moved, we see real quick how the rest fall in line. And I don't know about the safety net that we think is there has been exposed to kind of be pretty thin. And on one hand, there's a great resiliency going on now. I see people stepping up, and I have a friend of mine who makes masks. She's earning a living now making face masks. Mine's Batman, by the way, in case you were wondering. But, you know, so this is this thing that has sprouted up, and there are people doing incredible things. And then, of course, we look on the federal level, and I shake my head every day going, wait, what's going on now? And then we see at the state level what they're doing, and we see some of these things. This is kind of our blueprint in action. You know, it's easy when it's easy. When everything's humming along and they're making money on Wall Street, and you can go down to Walmart, and from Main Street to Wall Street, you can kind of get your things done. But when those pieces are removed, I think it shows the frailties, also the greatness, but also shows us who we are and who we're not, you know?
Let me use that point, well taken, to tell you one story on what this means to me. Courage. What is courage? My dad was a Marine and a Marine aviator, so yes. I grew up in military, and we're very familiar with all the battles. Courage to me was the young pilot at the Battle of Midway who has seen 100 of his classmates and fellow pilots auger in to the ocean trying to hit a Japanese carrier. But they went plane after plane, knowing the chances were almost zero that they would survive. To me, that was courage. Mm. The other is, the Marine Army guys who were going ashore at Tarawa, Okinawa, Iwo, Normandy, of course, knowing that they're probably not going to make it. The fatality rate is so high. Courage then, which chokes me up, 21-year-old kid, let's say 20, could be 18, young woman who has just graduated from nursing school, and she's there because she wants to help people. You don't go to make money. No. So she's all set to go and goes into the hospital and looks at her fellow nurses before they take their station. And they realize, we're going to go in there without proper safety gear. They have a deadly disease, and the chances that we are going to contract that disease are great, 80, 90%. And yet, as we know, they do it.
Yeah.
That courage compares to me with the fighter pilot. Mm. And so many other instances. But boy, if we don't give them a big medal and a big thanks, as we are, everybody recognizes that. That's a hell of a position to be in. But they do it because they wanted to help people. It's a passion.
You broke the whole story when it comes to Agent Orange. And back the cover-ups and all the other things, you know, and I have a couple of guys that I know that served in Vietnam that are still suffering to this day with this. And you know, they have to fight for their benefits, all that kind of stuff. And I keep thinking, as I was getting ready to talk, and we've had, we've known each other 30 years. I don't think there's anything we haven't talked about. But this morning, I thought I realized that I don't think I ever asked you how you felt personally. You're, as you said, son of a Marine, and you were a Marine yourself, and the line between being a journalist and going and doing this, and also being a veteran, going in and discovering this insidious plan, you know, that was dropped on the backs of our GIs in Vietnam that is costing thousands of lives. And yet the cover-up of the government and wasn't, you know, all that stuff that went on that you were part of and that you were able to break that story. I don't think I ever asked you how that affected you, if at all, personally, and if you're able to dissociate from that, because some of this to me sounds like this long career that you've had and so many things that you've been an advocate for and a champion for and a warrior for. To me, that's, for me, seems to be like the pivot point.
Yeah, it was. Still is. You know, and guys now are coming in with Agent Orange poisoning because it got into their fatty tissue, and when they hit 60, 65, they lose weight, and then the poison comes out again. But there have been 200,000 men compensated, and women, I presume, and in Vietnam, and 50 diseases that are connected with Agent Orange. But it was early on. I mean, it was a combination for me of wanting to do something for the veterans, and two, as a motivation, and two, I'm a lawyer out of Kansas, passed the bar in 66 before I came to Chicago. And I knew I had to get it right, and I wanted to be able to go. To get it right means you better be able to go to court. Mm. And, you know, here's my case, and look at my evidence, and it's going to hold. So in many ways, it was a puzzle. I had to prove that Agent Orange, incidentally, it was two chemicals that I had even used with my dad to take down the weeds in the pastures down in Kansas. And you'd come back, and you'd be soaked. And there were 40 years of studies that said, well, it's not harmful to humans. So we go up against that. On the other side were a dozen veterans who were reporting to the VA administration that, well, we have these symptoms, but the doctors, you know, had no answers. And there was one turning point that it was down in Mokena, I believe, or Mattoon. And in between the 6 and 10 o'clock newscasts, I went down and set up the camera in the living room. And a young man was having a variety of problems, and one of which was a birth defect. And so he sat there, and his little 4-year-old comes out and puts his hand on his dad's knee as we were talking. And the camera zooms in to his finger, and it was a little finger. And the tip of the finger, it's a congenital defect, was hanging just by skin. And it wasn't the biggest birth defect I had ever seen, but it was direct evidence. And so it was that picture that we took to Congress, and the hearing room was packed when we came in because the VA was going to just blow away that local station in Chicago. Mm. If it was a big story and real, why, the networks would have picked it up, wouldn't they? And it was about 10 minutes in, and all of a sudden, God, I break up every time I think. Mm. The crowd goes quiet. Like, oh, my God. It could be right. And it was silent until the end. And when the thing concludes, and it was a rough documentary, it was just slop. It wasn't slopped together as the best we could do at the time. Abner Mikva, the congressman, stood up and he said, you know, truth always comes out. And the VA representative stands up and said, well, here are 10 things that we're going to do, you know, to make it right. They had been fighting it because it was not established. We had to establish cause and effect.
Sure.
And we were up against 5 of the giant chemical companies. Well, years later, it lasted for years. So anyway, that was the big turning point. And the whole government gets in, and even though there was a lawsuit that resulted in a $180 million settlement, Congress, through the congressman, then doing the right thing, took over the issue and began doing 100,000 veteran surveys, and they stepped up to compensate everybody. But there was always, you know, there was a figure. You know, it was only 10 pounds of dioxin, the most, you know, that was included in 10 million gallons of this other chemical to carry it over, you know, Vietnam. And you say 10 pounds. Well, that was the argument they could use against it. But you stick with it and you realize, okay, here's evidence from the testimony of a veteran saying, yeah, we were up around Pleiku, and we saw the chemical dripping off the leaves. And when we came back the next day on patrol, the leaves had fallen off in 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the official time, it's a hormone that causes leaves to outgrow themselves, but that process takes about 2 weeks. So you have a difference of 2 weeks to 24 hours.
Right.
So something's wrong. It was years before, you know, the story is still out there. Compensation went forward, and we were correct. Everybody realized it. But it was years before we realized that. And the email, not an email, but it was a memo back in those days from an engineer inside one of the chemical companies floated up, maybe as part of one of the lawsuits. And it said, you know, we've been given this, the government just loved Agent Orange because they wanted to take down the fire fields
right.
So they could see the enemy.
Right.
They're fighting in the jungle. When the government ordered many, you know, millions of gallons more, it meant that the company said, can we increase our manufacturing and our loads? And they said, yes, we can do that, except if you turn up the heat, you're not only going to be creating millions of gallons of Agent Orange, you're going to be creating dioxin in weapon-grade amounts. So suddenly you changed from what the farmers used in the fields to what the soldiers used on the battlefield.
Mm.
Now, was that the devil talking? No, probably not. But it was the motive of money.
Mm.
And they could easily say, well, we're doing this for the country, and you know, to help out soldiers,
right?
And they were making money at the same time, and that is the difference.
It always comes down to the justification. And you sent me this. Well, you mentioned I already seen this. You said, "Have you seen what Trump's doing with mercury?" And this is the perfect segue for me because you sent this over the other day, and you talk about the justification of things, there's a bunch of one of the best sites to look at this stuff. Is EcoWatch. It's EcoWatch.com, and it says, as many Americans fight for their lives in the midst of a respiratory pandemic, the Trump administration, Thursday last week, axed the justification for a mercury pollution rule, there's the justification word, that saves more than 10,000 lives annually and prevents as many as 130,000 asthma attacks each year. The new rollback leaves mercury emission standards in place for now, but changes how their benefits are calculated so that the economic cost takes precedence over public health gains, the New York Times reported. And the former EPA director under Obama, Gina McCarthy, said in a statement, "This final rule will increase the risk of more kids with asthma and brain damage and more people with cancer," and goes on from there. And I find it amazing on one hand, you know, there are days I think the planet would be better off without us, and I think we're bent. We're the only. Well,
you're right.
You know what, Bill? I think that we, as far as my observation, experience, and opinion is, we're the only species that continually undermines its own life support system and are still here. I find it fascinating.
Yeah.
And when
this is where we live.
Yeah. When you mentioned this, when you mentioned this to me, that's kind of what tied me to the Agent Orange thing. It's about the money. And if we relax the standards that the industry that creates all this will make more money, but it's not always about the bottom line. It's about human lives. And here we are again.
Yeah. Well, you know, journalism is connecting the dots. And as I said before, we don't do the original research, but by God, we go in and we tell the stories of problems and also achievements. The reason I went to the Amazon and looked at the Yanomami, there was a report that the gold miners were invading their territory, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. What I didn't mention is that they were using mercury in the river to separate gold from the dirt and the water. So they destroyed the river in order to go down and dig up at the bottom of the rivers the gold. Was it worth it? Was it worth it? And in the process, give the illness, the TB, to the Indians. They don't care if they wipe them out. That's better for them. Mm. That's what we're doing to the rainforest, in addition to burning it. And I just read today where Bolsonaro, president of Brazil, is aggressively pushing forward to developing the Amazon. Aggressively. So, what a wonderful, uplifting.
I know. I don't know what's it. That's kind of my, you know, how many times did I walk into Curtis Productions with the scripts for Earth Matters and go, I am so goddamn depressed. I can't. And it goes back to the courage thing. I think about this all the time. And this is kind of where I want to wrap all this up with. You know, I feel for the most part, for the last 35 years that I've been working on these type of issues, I am just throwing a little pebble in the pond each day. I'm not throwing big boulders in. I'm just trying to throw something in there that is information for people that wherever they're at, they're not waiting for some government edict or mandate for change, that they do it themselves. Whether they have a second thought about, instead of throwing plastic in the garbage, they put it in some recycling. They just take an extra minute just to wash out the plastic and put it in a recycling container. Little things like that. Because I think what happens, and I had this conversation last summer with Dr. Jane Goodall. She said apathy is the problem. We have technologies, but it's people feel like they can't make a difference, so why should I even try? So you've been at this twice as long as I have. Do you still feel like it's worth the effort, that the big aha is still, you know, we can somehow pull our asses out of the sling in this?
Yeah. Let me tell you one story to that point, which was the very first New Explorers science education program. We did 100 shows for PBS. And we were in the Amazon, and it's where I got the name, New Explorers, because we went across this river. You know, whitewater with all our expensive gear. And I said, God, you're just like new explorers of old. If we could just educate kids on how exciting science can be, then we've done something. But I did an interview then there with the rainforest all around us of John Fitzpatrick, who was curator for the zoology department over at Field. And he said, and I said, why? Why do you do this? You're just getting, you know, a little piece of science at best, and yet you're in the middle of the rainforest, it took you days to get in, et cetera. You're risking disease and all that. He said, well, you know, I don't know the answer, frankly, but let me get my head together and ask me that again in the morning. So I went back, set up my camera, and asked him again. he said, well, we do it because we are learning one more piece, however small, piece of the world, how it works. And one day, when we need it, we might go back into the reserves at the Field Museum and the great institutions that do this kind of thing and have the answer. The answer is here for our survival. And I would take a step further. The answer is on the internet to coronavirus and everything else. But that carried me through 100 shows. We do it for another piece of the world. It's a puzzle. And all the pieces come together eventually, hopefully, to provide an answer and our own survival.
As always, he is spot on. The thing that's most important to me is that, again, knowing the man, and I'm going to tell you how we met, which is great, and it's a big part of all why I do what I do, is that he comes at it from a journalist. If you did not hear that through this whole conversation, you missed something. He's a journalist at heart, and that is what has brought him his international recognition and respect. He's also really, in so many ways, one of the last remaining stalwarts of that time where you were the roaming journalist and you were going around the world, and he's got camera crews and all the things that he's done, from breaking the Agent Orange story wide open to, you know, every other thing that he has touched in the media is always about bringing awareness to a problem and then maybe some solutions. So I'm not surprised on how that conversation went, but it never would have happened without John Denver. And I'd met John in the 80s. Over the years, I started going to this Windstar Foundation event that he would have once a year called Choices for the Future. I think I went in 1987 or 88, something like that. It was in Aspen, actually in Snowmass, Colorado. They had 1,000 acres there, the Windstar Foundation, where John had put his money behind this incredible effort. And a fellow named Tom Crum was his partner in this. And they built this great organization that did this symposium once a year. And named people came from all over the world to really get people moving in a good direction. It was a fantastic event. And I heard through the grapevine in 1989 that he was going to be in Chicago, John would be in Chicago, doing an event called Higher Ground. And what Higher Ground was about was the human consciousness side of all this. And I fall right in line with that. These problems that we have are all created by humans. There's no alien species that I know of outside of this universe, you know, messing with us. We do all this to ourselves within the biosphere that we live in. So this particular event was not a concert. It was more of his observations on human behavior and all that goes with it. So I was on the advanced team, marketing team, to help promote that. He was at the Chicago Theater. I did not know Bill at the time, but I did know him from television because he was a big deal here in Chicago, had already been on CBS National, and he and Walter Jacobson did the evening news, and they were, you know, the tag team. They were the dynamic duo. So I left a voicemail the night before the event, whatever, it was right around Earth Day in 1989, and I left Bill a voicemail on his phone, on his desk, and that was it. I invited him to come, thought it'd be great, try to get some coverage, what have you. Next night, the event starts, and, you know, they start opening the doors and the whole thing, and I'm no Bill Curry. Well, you know, I left the voicemail. It's all I really can do. And just prior to the event starting, before John took the stage, the place is filling up. Now, the Chicago Theater holds about 5,500, I think, 6,500 people, and it was three quarters full. Even though some people expected a concert, it was very obviously not that, even though we did a couple songs, but it filled up nicely, and we were glad with that. And as I'm walking down to my seat, which was the third row from the stage in the center, who but Bill Curtis comes walking down the same row from the opposite aisle, and we end up sitting next to each other, and I introduce you're the guy that, yeah, okay. And we've been friends ever since. That was in 1989. And now we're in 2020. Many years have gone by. And it was after that event that John and I and Bill and a few other of name and note hung out backstage and then in the little private VIP thing and talked about how do we apply ourselves to the challenges that we've all created and why it's so important for the few to do the work for the many. The many will not do the work. Only few do. So to that end, whenever Bill and I would do a public presentation of Earth Matters that we talked about a little earlier, last year it was at Northeastern Illinois University, and I always tell the story about John a little bit because without him, he was the catalyst. He's always been a catalyst in my life on a lot of different levels. But this particular time, it created a friendship that endures. And out of that friendship came everything you heard with Earth Matters and this fantastic conversation today. So I would be remiss if I didn't give John the last word on this.
This is called Amazon. There is a river that runs from the mountains. That one river is all rivers. All rivers are that one. There is a tree that stands in the forest. That one tree is all forest. All trees are that one. There's a flower that blooms in the desert. That one blossom is all flowers. All flowers are that one. There is a bird that sings in the jungle. That one song is all music. All songs are that one. It is the song of life. It is the flower of faith. It is a tree of temptation. It is a river of no regret. Child that cries in the ghetto. That one child is all of our children. All of our children are that one. There is a vision that shines the darkness. That one vision is all of our dreams. All of our dreams are that one. It is a vision of heaven. It is a child of promise. It is a tree of temptation. It is a river of no regret. For the mountains, let this be a voice for the rivers, let this be a voice for the forests, let this be a voice for the flowers.